Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. What is war like for the people who fight at the front? That's the question we're going to explore today as we speak with World War II veteran Art Thomas, a combat infantryman who fought with the United States Army in the epic battles at Leyte and Okinawa in the Pacific in 1944 and 1945. So please stay tuned for the next edition of History Counts, War and the First Person. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. What's it like to be a foot soldier face to face with the enemy in a desperate battle? To help us understand this unique experience, we're very fortunate to talk with World War II veteran Art Thomas about his experiences as a combat infantryman in the crucial battles of Leyte and Okinawa, which took place in the war's Pacific Theater between October 1944 and June 1945. Both battles were titanic. The fight for Leyte was accompanied by the largest naval battle of World War II, and the attack at Okinawa was the largest amphibious landing in the war's Pacific Theater. The early part of World War II had gone badly for the United States. Following the December 7, 1941 attack at Pearl Harbor, Japan invaded the Philippines, defeating the American garrison and taking many U.S. soldiers prisoner. As U.S. Commander Douglas MacArthur retreated, he uttered the famous words, "I shall return." But it was to be 2 long years before the U.S. could attempt to wrest control of the Philippines from Japan. So U.S. fortunes were at a low ebb in 1943 when Art Thomas, then a 19-year-old college freshman, was drafted into the U.S. Army. After initial training as an infantryman in Texas, Art was selected to participate in a special program in which promising young soldiers could complete their college education in needed professions such as engineering, and then be commissioned as officers in the Army. However, as we'll learn, the U.S. Army had a change of plans for Art. We pick up Art's story as a student in the college military program at Chicago's Illinois Institute of Technology. So it's the fall of 43 and you're at Illinois Institute?
Yes, and I'm there for a year. Washington realizes that they're going to invade Europe, they're going to land in Normandy, and they've got to do better in the Pacific, and the war is going slow, and they need men, so they decided no more college, and so they began to break up the college groups all over the country, and not just Illinois Tech, but all over the United States. So they broke up the program, and because I had my infantry training, and I was a bona fide infantryman with the basic and advanced training in Texas, boom, I and a handful of others were sent to the 96th Infantry in Oregon. Thing that we didn't know was the 96th Infantry had just been designated as an amphibious division. Therefore, they were going to go to the Pacific, period. There would be no Europe, no Germany, no France. We would go to the Pacific, and as a consequence, we had to start training for amphibious landings.
So you would practice landings on the coast of Oregon?
From Oregon down to San Diego, back up to the coast, up and down California. We were on ships all day long, up and down, in and out, climbing out, getting on the little landing crafts, learning how to get in, making landings on some of the islands in California, little islands like Coronado. Yeah, about 4 months. That's all we did. And in July of 44, we were sent to Pearl Harbor. And Nimitz and MacArthur and Roosevelt sat down and to decide where the next invasion was going to be. And MacArthur wanted to go to the Philippines. Nimitz said when Franklin Roosevelt called MacArthur Doug and Douglas MacArthur called him Franklin, he said, "I knew we were going to go to the Philippines," which it wasn't long before we were on a ship. And it was just wide open that we would go to an island called Yap. We would land in Yap, we would take Yap, and then we would go to another island. And that was just to fool the spies. And we had the maps for Yap. We had everything. And we got on the ships, and we went. And
did you know where your true destination was?
No, not at that point. We were studying the maps for Yap. The Yap being Y-A-P, an island. And then, about 2 weeks out, there was a big meeting, and they said, oh, by the way, we're not going to go to Yap. We're going to go to the Philippines.
And the 96th had not been in combat as a division before the Philippines?
Nope. It was around in the first war, but never saw action, and then deactivated, and then reactivated, and then torn apart by people leaving, and then being put together with college boys like myself.
The division was untested when they landed at Leyte.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, we had no idea how we would react either.
Now, what was the strategy in the Philippines attack? You didn't go straight for Manila. You went someplace else.
That's right. That's a very good point. MacArthur, having been living in the Philippines, and, you know, he knew it would have been foolhardy for us to go in to Luzon North, where Manila is and where the prisoners were, because that's where mostly the garrisons were. So he decided to land in Leyte, which is about in the middle of the Philippines, and Samar, and get a foothold. See, that was key. Get a foothold in the Philippines, then from there he could move north and take Luzon and get back his prisoners of war, and then see what the next step would be, whether it be the invasion of Japan or what. And so we went in, landed four divisions, the 96th, that's my outfit, the 7th, the 24th, and the 1st Cavalry Division.
This is on October 1944.
1st wave, 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning.
When did you first encounter resistance from the Japanese defenders?
The Japanese were garrisoned around the towns and the cities, not on a beach. So what they would do on the beach, they'd lob over some mortar shells, but you get used to that very quickly. In a couple of days, you get pretty used to mortar shells and artillery. You know, unless it's going to hit you right on the head or fall in your hold, you're pretty much going to survive. So we lost a guy the first night with a mortar shell, but there was no hand-to-hand fighting.
What was the terrain like? Was it swampy? Or
it was swamps and jungle and just bad. But there were towns and there were roads, and that's where you eventually had to go in, and that's when the resistance started. There was a battle of Dagami and the battle of Tabong, the battle of Tacloban, and all these towns, we had to take them.
Were you involved in the fighting around Catman Hill?
Yes, absolutely.
That was a significant promontory, I understand, where the Japanese would shell Americans landing.
Well, that's exactly where the 33rd, my regiment, our assignment was, Catman Hill. Exactly.
How did you capture that?
Just by brute force. Nothing spectacular, nothing clever, nothing pretty, just fighting through the swamps, getting position, going up the hill, just constantly shooting, fighting until you overwhelm them. In other words, I think we had more people than they did. We landed about 60,000 troops, give or take, and there was only about 25,000 Japanese. There's a whole range of hills, and you just go up and you just keep fighting, and people die, and people get hit, and eventually you wake up and say, my goodness, we finally took this hill. Now we're going to go on to the next peak. There was a lot of disease, too, and that was probably worse than anything. And I got dengue fever, so I missed 14 days of combat.
What do they do with you when you're sick?
Oh, well, you go to the beach, and they've got a tent set up, and they call it a hospital with some cots. Well, I had 104 fever. That's a dengue fever. It's a first cousin of malaria. So for all intents and purposes, you might say I had malaria. Just high fever, extreme weakness, and after about 10 days or so, they sent me back, and I was, you know, I was just exhausted. I was practically worthless. Even when I got back to the outfit, I did a lot of laying down.
Well, now you'd had all this training in Oregon and Hawaii, but what is it like that first moment when you realize that someone is shooting at you?
Well, that's pretty bad, because you could go up and down in those little boats, up and down, up and down, up and down, and then suddenly you move in and you're going to hit the beach, and the door goes down, and when you come running out, you just don't know what's going to happen. You assume that they're going to be shooting at you, and when they don't, you can't understand it, you know, and because it's just, it's very very, very difficult. Those were probably the most difficult times. You don't know whether you're going to throw up or what. But after that, you get pretty, how can I say it? You learn quickly. You see somebody get hit, and you see somebody get shot, and you learn very quickly that if you don't kill them, they're going to kill you. It's as simple as that. You kill or be killed.
Oh, you're not thinking about the purpose of the war at that point. It's a question of just kill or be killed?
No, the purpose of the war was absolutely insignificant. It was, here I am in the Philippines, never dreamed I'd be here. What am I doing here? And I know that if I don't kill, I'll be killed. And the more we kill, the sooner I'll go home. That's exactly what you think.
And this fighting went on for such a long time. You landed on October 20th, and the battle went on until January. Is there any moment at which you can be off guard where you can get a good night's sleep?
Because in the Philippines, it was kind of wide open. For example, you mentioned Catman Hill. After we landed, we moved through a swamp. It took 3 days to go through that, and nobody was shooting at us because the Japanese didn't think anybody would be stupid enough to try to get through the swamp. But we outmaneuvered some Japanese by doing it and getting to Catman Hill. You do not fight every minute. There are times when they're regrouping and you're moving, and maybe they're getting their garrison ready around this town because they know we're going to come into that town and fight them. And so you might go 2 or 3 days and not fight, see?
One thing that astounds me as I looked at the statistics that of an estimated 55,000 Japanese defenders, 49,000 were said to be killed. The Japanese would just fight and fight? They did not surrender?
They did not surrender, and we didn't give them much chance to surrender either. You just shoot everybody, that's all. This is the infantry. You don't have food coming up. You don't have cooks and bakers, behind you. You're living on rations that you grab to open up a can of beans or a can of stew that you got from a box that was dropped maybe from air, and you have to travel through swamps, and this is the Philippines, and you're getting bit by the Anopheles mosquito, and you'll probably come down with malaria. That was a very unique, special situation. And that was it. And we fought. Now, MacArthur was already thinking of moving more troops north to get to Luzon, and that's where the bulk of the Japanese were.
You did not move north to Manila yourself.
I did not.
Although you were involved in the intense fighting through this early part of the campaign in Leyte through January,
right.
From October to January, then they had other plans for you.
Well, what happened was there was a big surprise. They start moving north toward Luzon, and we didn't move. The Okinawa, which was only about 300 miles from China and maybe only 600 miles from Japan, was in a very, very strategic spot. And the Air Force was beginning to bomb Tokyo. They would fly a long distance to Tokyo, and they dropped their bombs, and on the way back, they didn't have any place to land. They'd run out of fuel, and sometimes they'd have to ditch in the ocean. So it became important to get some key island, and Okinawa stood out like a sore thumb.
So Okinawa is north of the Philippines and in an island chain south of the main part of Japan.
So it's the Philippines, Okinawa, and Japan, almost from south to north, give or take a few degrees,
So with the capture of Okinawa, the United States would have a good springboard for the next step
Japan. That's what happened. So what we didn't know, all of a sudden we start training on different vehicles and different techniques and this and that through the month of February and March and had no idea where we were going. And, we didn't think we were going to Japan because we knew that Japan was too big and you just couldn't take it without involving everybody in the entire Army and Navy. It just wouldn't happen. So we got on a ship, and lo and behold, they told us we were going to Okinawa. Never heard of it. And come to find out, there was 60,000, 70,000 Japanese garrisoned there, and they had another 20,000 National Guard. So there was about 100,000 Japanese on Okinawa, an island about 70 miles long. And the northern part was pretty hilly, so they all lived and soldiered in the southern part, and that's where we landed.
This would be on April 1st, 1945.
April 1st, 1945, we landed 4 divisions abreast, 2 Marine and 2 Army. the two Marine divisions, the 1st and 6th, they went north, and the 96th, my outfit, and the 7th went in and went south. And we landed, and we went in, and then we, again, very few people were killed on the beach. Very few, I think. A little mortar shell here, a sniper there, a shot there. Maybe you lose a couple of guys the first few days. This was unheard of in island warfare in the past, where they tried to keep you off the island, which turned out to be pretty stupid because they knew the Americans would eventually get a foothold, you know, because we were always more powerful, had more men. But in this case, they chose to occupy the island, move back into important positions, and just wait for the American to land and come up. Even though we've only fought in the last 10 miles, it was about, maybe 6 miles across and 10 miles long. And in the south, where all the, and this is important, this is where all the, really the ridges were that went across the island that you could sit behind and keep off a whole army, you see.
This is Cactus Ridge and Kakazu Ridge.
Yeah, and yeah. Kakazu, all of those. They could just sit back there and keep us off for, you know, days and days and days and days. And now one more thing, when they do that, they would keep the entire armed forces from advancing, and then you'd fight for 10 or 12 days, and finally, the Japanese would decide that they've had enough, and they would move back to the next line of ridges that went across the mountain. And so the next day when you attacked, you'd go up there, and there wouldn't be anybody there.
Defensive positions.
Right. And they're always on top of the hill looking down, and you're always going up that hill.
Do you think they fought more fiercely because you were so close to the Japanese
homeland?
Absolutely.
They even had orders from the emperor. The emperor told them, it's now obvious that the Americans are going to invade Japan, because there we were in the Philippines, and then Okinawa. You know, you're only 600 miles from the southern tip, and you had to be foolish if you didn't think we could make it. He told them, prolong the war as long as you can, and that's exactly why they didn't fight us on the beach. They would set up a resistance line across the island, and they could keep you off for days and days and days. If your division happens to be right here and you're moving forward and that's where they're going to take a stand, then you get it, and the guy to your left may not get it. In other words, you could be getting blasted and your guys are getting killed left and right. And a mile to the left or 2 miles to the left, another outfit is just holding, you see. And I got Kakadu Ridge, and that was bad. On the 10th day of the island we were there, we hit Kakadu Ridge, and that was bad. That was bad. A lot of guys were killed, and I'm going to digress a minute now. Buddies and foxhole buddies, they discouraged that. And I had two buddies. One of them was Joe, and one of them was Johnny. Joe was from South Bend, Indiana, and Johnny was from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and we were inseparable. We fought all the time together. We dug in together, and you know, we were always together. And they don't like to see that, because they know that somebody's going to get killed, you know, eventually. And sure enough, Joe and I made it, and Johnny was killed on Okinawa. And about that time, a little bit after Kakadu Ridge, I think he was killed on the 12th.
How do you cope with that? Is there any time for grief?
I believe it or not, and I'm not being melodramatic, I think about it, even now I think of him. I can see his face as clear as a bell. And that was 65 years ago.
How old was he when he died?
We were all the same age. Well, 18, 19, 20. You know, take your pick. I was 20, 21 or 22. We were all the same age.
So you led, 8 or 10 men in the squad?
Eventually, I had 8 or 10 men in the squad, 10 men. And then I took over the section. And then I took over the platoon near the end of Okinawa.
So many men had been killed that you
were
advanced.
That's right. You know, if you live long enough, you will become a sergeant. You're just a platoon sergeant. You'll take over the platoon because everybody either gets hit or killed.
If you looked at your company as it started the Battle of Leyte and where it was at the end of the Battle of Okinawa, how many casualties do you think approximately you suffered in your company?
More than 80%. Casualties, because that includes wounded, killed, missing, and don't forget, on Okinawa there was a lot of what you call combat fatigue. It was such a difficult, devastating battle, and it was so hard that a lot of guys just, you know, lost their whatever you could lose. We lost our full colonel. We lost our assistant division commander, one-star general. We lost the army commander, the 10th Army general, four-star general. These guys were killed, you know, by shrapnel up there near the front.
Now, I understand that the Japanese would dig into caves and have pillboxes. How do you approach a cave?
Well, a couple of ways. When you can get a tank up there, which wasn't always the case on Okinawa because it was a coral island and very difficult to maneuver in this coral because it was so scraggy, you know, with flamethrowers on a tank, that would help. And with flamethrowers, guys who could get up there close enough with a flamethrower. But generally, it was just constant bombardment, and you just get closer and closer, and then somebody gets close enough to throw a grenade in there. And
did you throw grenades into caves yourself?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And then someone has to go into the cave to make sure that the enemy soldiers are dead or incapacitated?
Yeah, but that's not necessarily true, because too many times somebody gets shot. We had what was called, in Okinawa, a little device that they developed called a satchel charge. And you could take this whole satchel charge and just throw it in the cave. And if they did indeed survive in there, they'd be dead after that. And that saved you from going in, because a couple of guys got hit. You know, nosing around caves is not a good idea anyway.
There's an old saying that there aren't any atheists in a foxhole. Is that true?
Very true. Absolutely. You're praying all the time. And if you do have a break, or if you go back for a little rest area and the father or chaplain comes up and wants to have a little sermon up along the side of a hill, everybody will go. I went. It was Catholic. He happened to be Catholic. I went. Absolutely. There's three things that you can count on for an infantryman. Number one, you're always tired, because you're running around and digging holes and fighting, and you're always, always tired. Number two, you're always hungry, because they can't get food to you, and you break up the boxes and grab a can of beans and a can of stew and put it in your fatigues, and you may eat that, and that's all you're going to eat for a day or two. So you're always hungry. And three, I'd say you're always frightened. I just would be willing to bet anytime a guy tell you, oh, it was a breeze, you know, I just walked up there with my old M1 and I just shot the two or three guys, blah, blah, blah. It isn't that easy at all. You're generally lucky if you survive, and lucky that you shot him before he shot you.
And the Japanese practically fought to the last man. It was 3 months. It was until the end of June before the Japanese resistance was broken. And I understand that the Japanese commanders, Ushijima and Cho, actually committed suicide.
Yeah, in fact, the ones that when we finally got to the end of the island, there were a lot of Japanese just committed suicide. Certainly the women and the nurses and all that, they all just dove off the cliff because they were convinced that the American was going to kill them or rape them or something. So near the end, and that's another thing. When you get near the end of a battle, everything just seems to go to hell. You know, the enemy is now very weak, and you're moving faster and faster, and people are jumping off the cliffs, and you're shooting everything that walks and moves, and you know you get near the end and it's kind of strange. But when you're fighting in the midst of a battle, like on the 10th and 12th day, when you don't know whether you're going to win or lose, it's different. But near the end, it's just, you know, you can get up and kind of walk and move and shoot and move some more.
So the Japanese civilians or the non-combat personnel were convinced they would be abused by the Americans, and that caused them to kill themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I don't remember very many prisoners. In fact, I don't remember any. It wasn't our responsibility to take prisoners anyway. You know, the infantry doesn't take time out, and you just bypass some people. You just bypass them. But I hate to tell you this, but you shoot people who get in the way, that's all. And if they had to be civilians, that's too bad, you know.
Well, the battle comes to an end at the end of June. What did you expect to happen next?
In May, Hitler dies, so the war ends in Europe. And we're told that everybody in Europe that his infantry is being put on ships and heading back to the United States and then the Pacific to get ready for the invasion of Japan. Obvious to everybody that after Okinawa, there was nothing left. There was nothing in between. The next step was going to be Japan, and the war is over. And they'd estimated about 1 million casualties. It was going to be tough, but we could do it, blah, blah, blah. Well, we had taken Okinawa, and we thought, oh, boy, this is going to be nice. It's not a bad island, you know. It's a little bit north. It's not so darn hot. And no. We all got on ships in the 96, headed back to the Philippines for the sole purpose of getting replacements to replace the dead, the wounded, and get ready for the big invasion in Japan.
Did you know where you were supposed to land in Japan?
Certainly not then, because the plan was so secret that only those five generals or five officers and the President of the United States knew what the plan was. We only saw this plan years later when you see pictures of it. And then I noticed that our division and our corps had been earmarked for the middle island just north of Tokyo. That's where we were going to land.
If it had not been for the dropping of the bombs, you would have been landing in probably the fall of 1945 on the coast near Tokyo.
I think it was scheduled for November. They had it scheduled for November invasion, and every bit of Japan would have been hit from top to bottom, and just hundreds of thousands of men, and we were just scheduled for that spot near Tokyo.
But as it is, the Japanese surrendered on 15 August 1945, and how long was it before you got home after the surrender of Japan?
Oh, boy. The war was over.
15 August was the surrender.
August, yeah. And I didn't get home until February. I was 6 months. 6 months.
So you're in the Army for 3 to 4 years.
3 years.
3 years. This has been a really intense experience, including the battles of Leyte and Okinawa and all of the casualties and the friends you lost. As you look back on it now, what sort of effect do you think it's had on your life, on your personality?
Well, it's not so bad now, but it had an effect on me in the early going. I thought about it a lot, but it's very vivid. It's very vivid in my mind. I can remember almost all of the fighting, almost all of it. And it did bother me a lot, but I swear, if I was in Okinawa, I can remember the beach. That's something I'll never forget. You remember the beach. You said, how does it feel? Well, when that door opens and you come blasting out, or like in Okinawa, you had to crawl out of a tank and onto a wall and onto the beach. I can remember the wall and the sand and everything about it, you know? And if I were there, I'd say, yeah, I remember that just the way it was. There's some things you just absolutely cannot forget, you know? You just can't forget it. It's just too devastating.
You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Art Thomas, now 86 years old, about his experiences as a combat infantryman at the battles of Leyte and Okinawa in the Pacific Theater in World War II. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.